or maybe Peter Bruegel, the elder. Some of them flew on leathery wings into the desert night air, with finger-like talons outstretched to rip into something soft. Some of them bubbled across the ground in uneven gaits, owing to the uneven number of legs they had and differing lengths of their limbs. A few of them galloped on those infamous cloven hooves, but all of them, without exception, had lots of sharp, pointy parts, and they stank like ass. Angus Ogg didn't waste time with introductions or even a respectable arch-villain laugh. He didn't taunt me or inform me I was about to die. He just pointed at me and uttered the Irish equivalent of, "Sick 'em, boys." Almost all of them did, but a couple of the bigger ones didn't. I distinctly saw one of the cloven-hoofed lads take off for the hills, and the largest thing on wings disappeared into the sky somewhere. Angus had the gall to be surprised at their defection. He actually shouted at them to come back, and I supposed he must have been counting on them to finish me off after the smaller ones roughed me up a bit. I saw the pack move to protect Hal and Oberon, who were chained up and unable to defend themselves from rogues or run away, and that gave me a brief moment's relief. "What did you expect, Angus?" I mocked him as I beheaded the vanguard. "They're bloody demons." And then there was no time for me to talk, because they were upon me, and all I could do was concentrate on what to kill next and on keeping down the contents of my stomach. After about 3 seconds, it occurred to me that I would be overwhelmed by sheer numbers or violent illness. An awful lot of the buggers had come out of that pit, and they were still coming. Luckily, they were still in front of me. They hadn't had time to try flanking me. So I drew a little of the remaining precious power from the earth, pointed at them with my index finger off the hilt, and shouted, "Doi!" as Briett had instructed, hoping that would take care of a few of them and bracing for the wave of weakness she warned me about. It turns out you can't brace for that kind of weakness. There was a thing with stork legs propelling a huge mouthful of teeth coming at my throat from my left, what looked like the Iron Maiden mascot coming at me from the center, and a horrific cross between a California girl and a Komodo dragon on my right. Every single one of them overshot me and even tripped over me as I abruptly dropped to the ground like a baby giraffe, my muscles utterly unable to function. Angus Ogg crowed in victory and yelled to Radomiwa, "I'm closing the portal now. He's dropped the sword. Do it!" Oh yes, the sword. The one my fingers were incapable of holding now. The one that was keeping me from becoming demon food. I needed power, and I tried to draw some, but when I reached for it, it went dead beneath me. Angus Ogg had drained it all to bring hell on earth. There was no telling how far I would have to go to draw enough strength to stand again. As it was, I could not move an inch. My night vision faded, and all I had to see by was the orange light of the fire pit. The skinless Iron Maiden demon scrambled back quickly and took the opportunity to snack on my ear, and the pain was unspeakable, worse than reading the collected works of Edith Wharton. But I couldn't muster the strength to pull away or even say ouch. Likewise for the armored mosquito the size of a schnauzer that landed on my chest and stuck its proboscis into my shoulder. I wanted to swat him, but I couldn't. Something with blue scales and a steroid habit hauled me up by my leg high into the air, and I saw a giant mouth of gleaming teeth, and I assumed I would be heading in there momentarily. The blood-sucking schnauzer mosquito assumed that as well, because it pulled out with a wet pop and flew away. But then I was dropped unceremoniously to the ground, breaking my left wrist in the fall. I had fallen facing the hell pit, so I had a view of the horde and of Angus Ogg berating death.
"Well, he's obviously dead by now, so what are you waiting for?"
"Not dead yet, Angus. Dead in short order, perhaps, like the wasted land beneath me. But perhaps not." The horde of demons wailed and gnashed their teeth from an epic case of fiery, yet somehow cold, heartburn, forgetting about me for the most part. The flying ones hadn't been affected by the cold fire, so the giant mosquito found me again and began to suck me dry. Unlike normal mosquitoes, it didn't inject a local anesthetic to deaden the pain when it stabbed me. But I bet its saliva would leave a much nastier mark afterward, if I lived to deal with it. The demons I'd hit expired in several ways from the cold fire. Some of them melted into a puddle of goo, some of them exploded, and some of them flamed up briefly before scattering as ashes. The one who had eaten my ear ended that way. I'd never hear from him again, nor would I ever be able to appreciate Iron Maiden properly.
"What's happening?"
Angus asked rhetorically, then answered it like the insufferable ass he was.
"Oh, I see. Cold fire. That means he must be weak as a kitten. Where's the sword, Radomila?"
"Buried underneath demon goo a few yards away from me. Why would she know anything about that? And what was it he had commanded her to do earlier? And hey, Angus, are you going to do anything about the rest of the demons that didn't get hit with cold fire? Like the flying one on my chest, and the ones that came out of the pit after I used the spell but before you closed it? He'd probably let them all go, and they'd wind up blending in with the population of Apache Junction." The werewolves were tearing into anything that came near Hal or Oberon. Good. But they would need my help to break those silver chains, and I couldn't even help myself right now. Radomila sounded apoplectic.
"I can't find it. I know it's here, but I can't pinpoint it."
"Then explain what good you are to me," Angus spat.
"The one thing you guaranteed me is that you'd be able to find the sword and bring it to me even if he removed the cloak you put on it. Now you tell me you cannot?"
"Ha ha. I didn't remove the cloak. Laksha did. And when she removed it, she must have dispelled whatever tracer Radomila was trying to find. Laksha hadn't tried to hide Fragara's natural magical signature, though, so that was why Radomila knew when I'd drawn it. She just couldn't get a fix on its location. Speaking of Laksha, shouldn't she have made some progress by now?" Radomila was about to offer Angus a snarky retort when her eyes flew wide open and lost their focus. Ah, yes. Here we go. That look meant that Radomila sensed someone had a target lock on her ass. But this was one tail she couldn't shake. It was her own blood, after all.
"Answer me, witch!"
For a god of love, Angus was remarkably blind to nonverbal cues. Radomila wasn't worried about him or any promises she had made right then. She was feverishly trying to figure out a way to ward off whatever was coming for her. Too late. Her skull caved in from four directions, as if four railroad workers had swung their hammers perfectly in sync from the cardinal directions. Bits of brain and blood splattered the inside of the cage and even sullied the pristine armor of Angus Og. Now that is why I am paranoid about witches getting hold of my blood. Druid's Log, October 11. Never make Laksha mad. The giant sucker popped his proboscis out abruptly and took off. He wasn't full, so I assumed that something bigger and badder was coming to take a bite out of me. It wasn't bigger, but it was definitely badder. As the talons sank into my chest, I recognized the battle crow, the Morrigan, as a chooser of the slain. Her eyes were red, not a good sign. Angus Og recognized her too, and he finally spied me lying there amongst all the ruins of his demon army as he whirled around, trying to figure out how his pet witch had gotten smushed. He looked uncertainly at Death, who had passively watched all the proceedings, but the hooded figure shook its head at him and then pointed in my general direction. He was pointing at Laksha in the woods behind me, of course, not at me, but Angus made the logical conclusion given his lack of information.
"Ah, did you do that, Druid? Didn't know you had it in you? Well, it won't help you at all. There's the battle crow on you now, just like old Cahoolin, and she will be supping on your eyeballs soon. I bet you can't move a muscle right now."
I entertained the possibility that he was right, and that the Morrigan would betray me after all. But the crow's eyes flashed even redder, and I knew that Angus had made a fatal error. The Morrigan does not like to be taken for granted. I think he realized it too, for he had taken a step toward me, but halted at the flash in her eyes. I heard her voice in my mind.
"He has killed this land for his dreams of power. He thinks the sword will let him stage a coup in Tir na n'Og, and for that he has betrayed his most sacred bond. He is corrupt."
She shifted her talons painfully in my chest as she thought aloud, piercing me anew and either careless or unconscious of what she was doing.
"I should not directly help you, but I will if you keep it secret from all. Agreed?"
I didn't have to think very hard. I agreed.
"I am lending you my own power to fight him on equal terms."
I began to feel my muscles again.
"If you live, I will require it back. If you die, it will return to me in any case. Agreed?"
Again I agreed with her, and I began to feel much better. My left wrist healed, the weakness disappeared, and the wound where my ear had been at least closed up,
though the ear didn't grow back. "Would you mind hunting down that mosquito demon and obliterating it for me, please, while I take care of Angus? It has an awful lot of my blood." The battle crow squawked in irritation and shook its wings. Angus Og took a cautious step forward, and the crow's eyes blazed again in warning. Angus halted.
"Morrigan, what's going on?"
he asked. She squawked at him threateningly, and he held up his hands and said,
"All right, take your time."
"Very well," she said to me. "You know he is carrying Moralta?"
I did not, but thank you for telling me. Moralta was a magical sword like Fragara. In English it would be called Great Fury. It had an interesting power. Its first blow was supposed to also be the coup de grace. One hit and you'd be done. Under the fine magical print, it had to be one solid hit, not a glancing blow. And it was definitely not activated by simply clashing with an opponent's sword or shield.
"You are aware of its power, then, and how you must attack?"
"Well aware, thank you. I'd have to put him on the defensive and prevent that blow from ever falling, especially since I had nothing on but 100% cotton. And he, for his part, would have to guard his entire body just like me, because my sword's ability meant his armor was about as protective as my jeans and t-shirt." Fragara, in English, the Answerer, also had a couple of other abilities. It gave me control of the winds, but I didn't need that so much, living in a desert. And if I held it at someone's throat and asked them a question, they'd have to tell the truth, hence the Answerer. Perhaps I'd ask Angus, if I got the chance, why he wanted my sword so badly when he already had a neato-schmido sword of his own. It was going to be an interesting duel.
"You should be ready now. Fragara is behind you and to the right, underneath the melted body of that lizard creature."
The Morrigan withdrew her talons from me and launched herself on a course for Angus Og. That sort of thing would worry anyone, and his eyes were fully upon her as she approached. While his attention was thus diverted, I sprang up, feeling remarkably well, and retrieved a gooey Fragara from underneath the liquefied bosom of the California girl Komodo dragon. I recast night vision on myself and turned my head just in time to see the Morrigan let loose with what may politely be called a white blossom, square in the visor of Angus Og's helmet. He cursed and clawed at his face, and the Morrigan croaked her laughter. I kept silent with effort and stripped off my shirt to clean the blade and hilt of Fragara, smiling as I did so. Then I realized that amusement was not the proper frame of mind for me to cultivate right now. 40 yards away from me stood the man who had done me and the earth more wrong than any other. He removed his helmet, wiped the crow shit from his eyes, and checked to be sure he still had his captives and that the werewolves were staying put. They were defending Hal and Oberon from the attack of stray demons, but showed no signs of taking the offensive. He checked on Death, who remained astride the pale horse, unmoving. Satisfied, he turned to where he thought I was lying on the ground, and instead saw me standing up with Fragara in hand.
"Sheehan O'Sullivan," he sneered, drawing Moralta out of its sheath. "You've led me a right merry chase, and if there were any bards left to sing of it, they'd probably write a ballad about you. A proper one where the hero dies at the end, and the moral is don't ever feck with Angus Og."
Spittle flew from his mouth at the end, and his face turned purple as he shook with rage. I didn't respond. I just glowered at him and let him realize he had lost his self-control. He ground his teeth together and took a deep breath to recollect his composure.
"That sword," he said, pointing at me with his own, "is the rightful property of the Tuatha De Danann. You cannot escape me now except by begging for mercy. Drop the sword and fall to your knees." "This guy is an epic douche. Kick his shiny ass, Atticus,"
Oberon said. I compartmentalized his comment and resolved to enjoy it later. I glared at this would-be usurper and said in my most authoritative voice, "Angus Og, you have broken druidic law by killing the land around us and opening a gate to hell, unleashing demons on this plain. I judge you guilty and sentence you to death."
"Amen, Atticus. Testify!"
Angus snorted in derision.
"Druidic law doesn't apply here."
"Druidic law applies wherever I walk, and you know this."
"You have no authority to enforce your law upon me."
My authority is here. I waved Fragara and tapped its power to send a gust of wind at Angus. I only meant to intimidate him with its creepiness, but I must have put too much of my anger behind it, because the gust was so powerful it blew him backward onto his silver-plated derriere.
"You will respect my authority,"
Oberon said, in a passable imitation of Eric Cartman. I reminded him that I needed to concentrate. Sometimes dogs forget. They just get too excited. I noticed that I had lost some energy by performing that little trick. The power to control winds may be inherent to Fragara, but the will and force had to come from somewhere, and since I couldn't tap the earth here, it came directly from me. That is, it came from the energy Morrigan had lent me. That changed everything. If I was going to get tired, I couldn't fight him the same way. He was in the same situation, of course, so instead of charging him, I remained where I was and laughed. "Go ahead, Angus. Get angry. Throw some magic at me and spend yourself and see what happens." I put my left hand up to my necklace to reassure myself that it was still there and undamaged as Angus struggled to get up. The spikes on the backs of his calves and the spurs on his ankles were giving him trouble, and I laughed all the harder. The werewolves started yipping at him, too. Most of the little demons had either cleared off or been killed, so they were able to watch the spectacle a bit and enjoy the Silver Man's difficulty. His face red and flushed, he gave me one of those "you will pay" looks and whipped his left hand at me as if he were throwing a frisbee. But what came at me wasn't a pleasantly spinning plastic disc. It was a bright orange ball of hellfire, the sort that you get to fling around only if you've made a deal you really shouldn't have. I'm not going to pretend my sphincter didn't clench. My survival instinct is too well developed. But other than that, I gave no outward sign that I was concerned about the hellfire as I stood my ground. Now I'd find out how good my amulet was. You know how it feels when you've nuked a hot pocket and you touch it too fast before it cools down? Well, the hellfire was like that. A flash of intense heat that was gone in less than a second, leaving nary a mark but setting my entire body to sweating. Angus couldn't believe it. He thought he'd see a crispy critter clutching a glowing sword, but instead he saw an annoyed, very live druid staring back at him, clutching a glowing sword.
"How is that possible?" he erupted. "Druids have no defense against hellfire. You should be dead."
I said nothing but began to circle around to my right, trying to get to some ground that wasn't covered with slippery demon leftovers. It was at this point that the figure on the pale horse began to laugh. Everything in the meadow stopped breathing, listened to the cloaked figure's hoarse, raspy chuckle, and wondered what it thought was so funny. Taking advantage of the pause, Angus Og's uncertainty, and the dry ground, I charged. What more was there to say? I'd sentenced him to death, and he'd demonstrated he wouldn't submit meekly, so there was nothing left but to go to it. I wanted one of those fabulous anime moments where the hero sticks the sword into the bad guy's guts and everything quivers, even the sweat droplets, and the bad guy vomits blood and says something in a tiny surprised voice like, "That really was a Hattori Hanzo sword," right before he dies. Alas, it was not to be. Angus had been something of a swordsman in his earlier days. He'd helped the Fianna out of a tight spot or two. He had serious battlefield cred, unlike Bress. He parried my first flurry of blows, cursing all the while and promising to mutilate my body and then dig up the bones of all my descendants and turn them into glue, blah, blah, blah. He tried to back up, disengage, and give himself some space to begin a counterattack. That was precisely what I could not afford, so I pressed the attack and realized we were both fighting in the old Irish patterns, which was perhaps all he knew, but it certainly wasn't all I knew. I hadn't spent centuries in Asia and the last 10 years sparring with a vampire to fall into old ruts like that. I switched my attack pattern to a Chinese series of forms that incorporated some deceptive wrist movements, and that brought me some success. He crossed his sword above him to parry a blow from above, only to find that it was coming from the side instead. The blade bit deep into his left arm above the elbow, and I snapped it out when I felt it hit bone. He yowled his pain, and I think he tried to say something, but it was so mangled with spittle and inchoate rage that I didn't process a word. His left arm was useless now, hanging there like a mesquite branch damaged in a monsoon, and his balance would be skewed. I could gamble a wee bit,
People with poor balance rarely win sword fights. I backed off and let him bleed, allowing him to weaken with every passing second. He'd use some power to stop the bleeding, and that was fine with me. He'd still be weakened, and there was no way he could knit the muscle tissue in time. It was his turn to attack. I knew he'd do it. At this point, we hated each other as much as it was possible for two Irishmen to do. And that's quite a bit.
"You've hounded me for centuries," I growled. "And you might have hounded me for many more. But your petty jealousy of Briett has brought you to this end."
"Your end, you mean?"
Angus roared, completely unhinged by my reducing all his elaborate schemes to a case of sibling rivalry. He lunged at me with a long diagonal hack, with all his strength behind it, but I knew how he fought now, the same old way. I saw it coming, and I knew I was faster and stronger, too. I parried his blade by sweeping mine in a rainbow move to my right, so that his sword was underneath mine when I brought it down and his sword arm was crossed in front of him. I stepped forward quickly and whipped Fragorath through his neck before he could regain his balance and try a backhand. His head tumbled backward, eyes wide in surprise, and wound up bouncing off his back as he fell to the ground.
"No, I meant your end," I said.
Death laughed again and goaded his horse toward us. I stood aside as the rider reached down and scooped Angus Og's head from the ground, then began to tack his horse back around to the fire pit, laughing maniacally all the while. The love god's mouth did not move, but still I heard him protest.
"No, the Morrigan is supposed to take me, not you. Morrigan, take me to Tir na n'Og. Morrigan!"
The pale horse of death leapt with its rider and cargo into the fire pit and descended back to hell, and I was finally free of Angus Og.
Chapter 25.
"All right, that's over. Now get me off this chain and buy me a steak,"
Oberon said.
"You got it, buddy. Let me get the werewolf free first so the pack doesn't think I'm insulting them. You understand the need for diplomacy here, right?"
"Yeah, but, geez, they have such fragile egos. You wouldn't think they'd be so sensitive."
The werewolves gave me some appreciative yips as I approached Hal and took the black bag off his head. His eyes were yellow and his wolf wanted out, but the silver wrapped around him was preventing it. His chest was heaving, and he was just barely able to hold on to his language faculties.
"Thanks, Atticus,"
he managed.
"Saw through Packlink. You know, red-haired woman who warned about silver traps?"
"Yes, I do. That was Flittish." I frowned as I bent to examine his chains. They were locked with a padlock, and I wasn't a locksmith. Trying to dissolve the chains magically would take too much time. Someone had to have the key. "Why do you ask?"
"She was the one who kidnapped us."
"What? I thought that was Emily."
"No."
He shook his head.
"No, she drove car. Flittish talked us into back seat."
I looked over at Oberon. "Why didn't you mention this before?" I asked aloud so all could hear.
"I was going to, but you haven't exactly let me talk very much. Hush, Oberon. Quiet, Oberon. Not now, Oberon."
"Fair enough," I said. "Hal, I need a key. Any idea who has it?" He jerked his chin in the direction of Radomiwa's remains.
"Dead witch."
"Yuck. That's gonna be messy." I walked over to the other side of the cabin where the cage was and grimaced at Laksha's handiwork. Radomiwa had been wearing a fine leather jacket, and once I dragged her corpse to the edge of the cage where I could reach her pockets, I found several keys in her right one. There was a lock on the cage she was in, and I unlocked that first to go inside and retrieve the necklace for Laksha. It was a bloody mess. The phrase, "oversized with coagulate gore," came to mind. But since she had caused it, I figured she couldn't complain. I went over to Hal next, who was panting heavily in anticipation. "Are you going to go wolf as soon as I unlock this?" He nodded, too wound up to answer. "All right, tell the pack this for me. If they see Flittish, leave her alone. She's promised to come back and help with your wounded. What I need you to do is go after Emily and bring me her head." That got his attention.
"Her head?"
"Yes, I need it. Do what you want with the rest, but don't tear after her until we make sure those traps are disabled. Either Flittish can tell us or Laksha might be able to when she gets here."
"There is no need, Druid," said the Morrigan,
who had flown down and taken her human form beside me. She was naked again, Must be feeling randy after watching an ancient rival get decapitated.
The traps expired when that witch did, she said, gesturing at Radomiwa's leftovers. They were not permanent enchantments.
Thank you, Morrigan, I said, and turned to Hal and began unlocking him. There you go. Hunt well. I'll wait here and take care of your wounded as best I can. The chain smoked a bit where they had come into contact with Hal's flesh, peeling some of the skin away with them. He hissed and snarled and changed form as soon as the silver chains were off him, ripping right through his nice $3,000 suit, for which I had no doubt I would be billed. The pack surrounded him and welcomed him back. Then he took his place next to Gunner as they ran to the spot where Emily had left the meadow to begin their hunt. "Did you ever find that blood-sucking demon, Morrigan?" I asked as I unlocked Oberon. He gave me some sloppy kisses and I hugged him.
"Found and destroyed," she said. "Did you notice that my casting came true?"
"Aye, I noticed that," I replied, smiling, though it applied to Angus Og, as I'd rather hoped. "May I ask you something?"
"Certainly."
"Did you tell Angus Og of our arrangement, that you would never take me?" She slunk up next to me and overwhelmed my libido with that peculiar magic of hers, which my amulet could mute but not negate. She ran a fingernail down my bare chest, and I forgot to breathe.
"Oh, but I am going to take you, Druid," she said. "Many times, when you've recovered your strength."
She snaked her tongue into my remaining ear.
"Oh, jeez, here we go again."
Oberon mentally rolled his eyes. "That's not what I meant," I managed to say, pulling away. I determinedly began to think of baseball. Randy Johnson pitching, great player, but not sexy. No sex. Stay focused. "Did you tell him you would never come for me?" She laughed throatily and latched onto my left side again, her breath tickling my neck, and I reddened.
"I mean, did you tell him that you'd never take my life?"
"Yes,"
she whispered in my ear, and I had to close my eyes. Two outs, nobody on, bottom of the first, completely unsexy. "Why?" She dug her nails into my pecs and I gasped, remembering when they were talons.
"I wanted him to summon death," she said, "so that when you killed him, I would never have to see him again. I knew he would do it when I told him of our agreement, and he did. Thus, I am eternally revenged for millennia of petty annoyances. He is now in a hell he never imagined for himself, denied his rest in Tir na n'Og. Am I not a fearsome enemy?"
"You frighten me primally." The Morrigan sighed and ground her pelvis against my leg. What do you know? She liked to be told she was scary. Kinky. Why did he want Frogara so badly? I wondered. I never got to ask him.
"There is a faction in Faerie, a rather large one, that thinks you should not wield it, since you are neither Fae nor of the Tuatha De Danann. They think Briat has let too many of the old ways go, and allowing you to keep Frogara is something they point to as evidence of their claims."
"So I'm a political football in Tir na n'Og."
"I don't know what a football is,"
she breathed in my ear,
"but I know you are aroused."
Her left hand caressed the flat of my stomach and started to trail south to my jeans.
"You cannot hide this from me."
She abruptly whipped her head to the northeast, and fun time was over.
"Fleddish approaches. We will speak later. You have some power to return to me. Spend the night regenerating your own, and I will return in the morning."
The Morrigan turned back into a crow and flew off to the southwest, even as Fleddish entered the meadow from the opposite direction. The goddess of the hunt gave me a cursory wave and ran over to Dr. Snorri Yodersen, who looked like a silver pincushion. Of the three other wolves who had fallen, two were turned back to human form, which meant they were dead. No wonder Hal and the pack were so eager to catch up with Emily.
"I don't know what to think about that red-haired lady,"
Oberon said as I ran to help the other surviving werewolf. He loped easily alongside me, happy to stretch his legs.
"She seemed so nice at first, but then she made me kill that guy and help kidnap us, and now she's trying to heal that poor wolf. Do you think maybe she has a split personality?"
"In a sense. She serves two masters."
"Really? Who?"
"Herself and Briat."
So the nice half of her personality must be when she serves Briet. I liked Briet. She called me impressive, which shows great judgment, and she also gave me a belly rub. If you see her again, remember she likes milk and honey in her tea.
I smiled. I missed you, Oberon. Let's see what we can do for this werewolf. It was a female I didn't recognize. She growled and snarled when she first saw us come into view, but she subsided abruptly after she recalled we had been with the pack. She had been stabbed under the left front leg and had a gash across the tendons of her right. They didn't look life-threatening, but she couldn't walk and the wounds wouldn't heal because of the silver traces in them. My magic wouldn't work on her, werewolf immunity. But if I could get her wounds cleaned up, she would heal herself. Easier said than done. Oberon, do you smell water anywhere nearby? He raised his snout to the air and took a few good long snuffles. He sneezed a couple of times, but he sounded sorry when he replied.
Well, I can't smell anything over the blood and demon stench. Why don't you just bring some up from the earth? I've seen you do it before.
Angus Og killed the land here. It won't obey me now.
Do not trouble yourself, druid, Flittish said from 20 yards in closing, running over to help. I can clean the wounds without water and get her healing started.
You can. You're already finished with Snorri? I looked over at Snorri, who was still lying on the ground as before, but without all the needles in him.
I am. He is healing now, and soon this one will do the same,
she said, kneeling down on her haunches and placing her tattooed hand on the werewolf's cut leg.
Her name is Greta.
Why are you doing this?
I told you I would come back to heal the pack.
But you were the one who kidnapped Hal and Oberon and put them in a position to be harmed.
Flittish hissed with impatience. I did so only at the instruction of Briet.
I felt the blood drain from my face.
What? Do not pretend you cannot follow me, she snapped. You know us well, and we know you even better. Admit it, druid. Without your friends being held hostage, there was a significant chance you would have simply fled the confrontation. Briet did not want that to happen, so I provided Angus Og with a lever to make sure you showed up to be attacked. Thus Briet got what she wanted, the removal of a rival, and Angus got what he deserved.
During this conversation, I missed what exactly Flittish did to remove the silver. I wanted to learn the trick because it could come in handy later, but when I looked back down, the werewolf's wounds were already beginning to close, and the last thing I wanted was to be in Flittish's debt. I supposed I would have to find a lever against her. I was flabbergasted by the extent to which I had been manipulated by various members of the Tuatha De Danann. I had indeed been a pawn for Briet, Flittish, and the Morrigan, a pawn who took down 2 very troublesome gods. Still, there were clear blessings to be thankful for. I was still alive, and my worst enemy was in hell instead of angling to become first among the Fae. I could think of nothing else to say to Flittish that would not get me in trouble, so I took refuge in good manners.
Thank you for healing the pack, Flittish.
It was my pleasure, she said, rising. And now I get an even greater pleasure. Did you see that one of the large demon rams escaped?
Yes, I saw that. Big lad he was.
I'm going after him now, she grinned. He's had a decent head start. Rams like him are casters, you know. It's going to be a fine chase, a finer battle, and he'll be a choice trophy on the wall of my lodge.
Happy hunting.
Very well, druid,
she said, and then she sprinted toward Haunted Canyon, using who knew what for energy in this wasted land. The Tuatha De Danann obviously had access to a power source that I did not, but I could see now that they had labored for millennia to preserve the fiction that they were as limited as druids were. Perhaps it did not matter anymore to keep it a secret. Who was I going to tell?
You know what she's like, Atticus?
What's that, buddy?
A piece of steak. You get caught in your teeth and you can't get out. I love me some steak, you know, but sometimes it can be supremely annoying, and then I don't want steak again for a while.
That's exactly what I feel too, Oberon. He turned his head toward Snorri and pricked up his ears.
Hey, I think your crush from the bar is coming.
She's my new apprentice. Well, half of her is anyway.
Wow, really? What's the other half going to do?
Not sure about that yet. Let's go meet her. I waved goodbye to Greta the werewolf, who was out of danger now, and Oberon barked a farewell. We loped over to where Dr. Yoderson was healing. He looked as if he wanted to sleep, but that was doubtless impossible with the pack link overflowing with bloodlust at the moment. "Thanks for taking one for the team, Snorri," I said. Oberon chimed in with a sort of rolling bark. Snorri snorted his acknowledgement, but otherwise didn't move. Laksha walked up behind Snorri, holding her nose.
"Smells like demons," she complained.
"Nice job on Radomiwa," I said.
"Did she have the necklace?"
"Yes, she did. I held it up so she could see her bloody treasure. The rest of the coven is just about finished off, so you won't need to use its power on them. Here you go, as promised." She took the necklace from me and smiled.
"Thank you. It is a pleasure to work with a man who keeps his word."
"I'm actually going to help you keep the remaining part of your bargain," I said.
"Oh?"
Her eyes narrowed.
"How so?"
"I'm giving Granuaile $30,000 to fly back east and find you a suitable host. Once you wake up in your new body, she'll give you the rest to get yourself set up somewhere, minus her airfare home."
"You have this kind of money to give away?"
I shrugged. $10,000 just came from the coven. As for the rest, I live simply and I make a killing on long-term investments. Send me a postcard when you get settled. Let me know how the karma rehab is going." Laksha chuckled and shoved the bloody necklace into Granuaile's pocket.
"I have no problem with this. Thank you for your consideration."
"Thank you for taking care of Granuaile."
"She is a sweet child and very bright. She will make a good druid."
"I agree. May I speak with her now?"
"Certainly. Farewell."
Granuaile's head drooped, and when it came back up, she staggered backward and covered her face with her hands.
"Oh! What is that fucking smell? Oh my god, it reeks! I can't...
She couldn't finish her sentence because she was too busy vomiting on the side of the trail. "Oh yeah, I forgot about that," I said. "Sorry. You kind of get used to it after a while." Granuaile vomited again by way of reply, and it occurred to me that I hadn't actually answered her question, and she might jump to the wrong conclusion if I didn't say something soon. "It wasn't me," I assured her. "I swear, it wasn't me. That's demons you're smelling."
"Whatever it is," she gasped. "Do we have to stay here for long? Because I don't think..."
She retched again, but now it was dry heaves. Part of me was finding this very interesting. Laksha had obviously been using the same nose as Granuaile, so the two had been exposed to the exact same stimuli, but Laksha had shown no urge to vomit so violently. It suggested that the physical reaction was even more psychologically based than I had previously supposed. "Well, I have to stay and wait for the pack to return, but you could go back up the trail a little way until you can stand it. There's nothing pretty to see here."
"Then why did you have me come back here?"
"Precisely because there's nothing pretty to see here. I wanted to give you a last chance to back out of our arrangement. You're about to become an initiate in the world of magic, and that world can sometimes be brutally violent and smell as evil as it actually is. Breathe through your mouth and look around."
"It's all dark."
"Oh, duh. My binding had snapped when I lost my energy and Angus Oak had drained the earth. Laksha clearly had used her own methods of seeing in the dark to get here. Using some more of the Morrigan's power, I gave Granuaile night vision again, and she looked at the meadow full of corpses.
"My God," she said. "Did you do all of this?"
"Everything except the witches and the two werewolves. But I had lots of help staying alive tonight. By rights, I should be dead. And you should know that magic users rarely die peacefully in their sleep. So I want you to think about what you're looking at and what you smelled as you take Laksha back east. I don't want you entering into this with any romanticized ideals. And if you'd rather not be my apprentice when you come back, I'll understand. No hard feelings. And I'll make sure you get a good job to replace the one you quit today."
"But what happened here? How did you manage this?"
"Whoa, hold that thought," I said, hearing yips from the opposite side of the meadow and seeing Snorri lift his head off the ground. "It sounds like the pack is returning. We may be able to leave sooner than I thought." Their arrival punctuated my point perfectly. Granuaile clutched my shoulder when she saw Emily's head dangling from Gunnar's jaws, and when he dropped it at my feet face up, she hid behind my back. "No, Granuaile, what are you hiding from? You need to see this, too. This is part of it. This woman here looked about 20 before she died, and now we see her true age was closer to 90. There are 7 more witches who are older than she was and who think they're wiser, so they might get ideas about trying to succeed where this one failed. Maybe seeing the head of their youngest will drive home the point that it's not wise to tangle with me. When you cannot reason with people, you have to try scaring them. If that doesn't work, then you either run or you kill them. Or set your lawyers on them.
Is that what you're doing? Trying to scare me?
Think of it as full disclosure.
Okay. Thank you. I will think about it.
She turned and started back up the trail.
I'm just going to go far enough ahead to where I can breathe normally again.
Gunner and Hal sloughed off their fur and put their human skin on so they could carry their 2 fallen packmates out of the wilderness. They didn't want to talk, and I figured they were probably calculating the costs of having me as a client. Snorri moved slowly and Greta trotted on 3 legs, but they were able to make it out without help now that the silver was out of their system. Before I left, I made sure to pick up Angus Og's sword, Moralta, since it now belonged to me by virtue of my victory. The hike out took much longer than the trip in, and we were a weary, silent lot, but we were back to the cars well before dawn. About 2 miles away from the trailhead, I could feel the earth again, and I wept as I walked. Hal and I dropped Granuel off at her apartment, and I told her to pack her bags for the trip east the next day. I didn't know if I would see her again or not. We made a call to Leif, who had woken up too late to join in the fun, and asked him to get his ghoul friends out there to clean up the mess. Hal took me to a 24-hour Walmart, and we bought gauze and tape to wrap around my chest where Fagel's bullet hole used to be. We also fabricated a story to tell the police when I got home. I had been so traumatized by the attempt on my life by a police detective that I spent a couple of days incommunicado at my girlfriend's house, and that would be Granuel for the purposes of the story. Hal said he'd straighten it out with her, then he drove me to my house and delivered me to the Tempe police, who were still staked out there, awaiting my statement. Hal was going to keep Oberon and Emily's head until they left. When they were finally satisfied with my story of a nervous breakdown, I called Hal to bring Oberon and Emily over, and then every other thought was of collapsing into the backyard to begin my true recovery from using cold fire. That had to wait. Too many things to do first. I made a special point of calling Melina Sokolovsky to tell her I had seen the sunrise, but Radomiwa had most definitely not. "I know you fully expected me to die, Melina, but don't you think perhaps you underestimated me?"
"Perhaps I did," she admitted. "There is so little available literature about the powers of druids, and it is difficult to judge. But I hope you recognize that you underestimated me as well, Mr. O'Sullivan."
"How so?" A thrill of panic shot down my spine. Did she get something of mine after all? Was I about to get magically squished?
"You thought me a liar, and that I was somehow involved in this abhorrent plot to make bargains with Hel and the Tuatha De Danann. I can understand why, because members of a coven tend to get painted with the same brush, often justifiably so. But looking back now, can you not see that I had only the best intentions?"
"You told me the truth about there being only 6 witches at Tony Cabin, and for that I thank you," I said. "But when I asked you at my shop how many of your coven were plotting to take the sword from me, you refused to answer."
"That is because I had no answer. At the time I had only suspicions, not confirmed evidence, and I could not share those with you and turn you against certain members of my coven without firm proof. Surely you understand this."
She was pretty smooth, and I found myself flirting with the idea that she might actually be an honest witch, as rare as an honest politician, if not more so. My prejudice would not allow me to trust her, but perhaps I did not need to send her Emily's head in a box as I had planned. Despite what I had told Granuel at the meadow, frightening people only pushes back the date of an inevitable fight. Cooperation makes fighting unnecessary, or, as Abraham Lincoln once said, "I destroy my enemies when I make them my friends." "What has your coven decided to do now?" I asked. "Hunt down the druid that killed your sisters?"
"Of course not," Melina scolded. "They clearly gave you just cause, and they got their just deserts. I told them it might not turn out well."
"What are your plans, then?" Melina sighed.
"That actually depends quite a bit on your plans, Mr. O'Sullivan. If you are planning some sort of pogrom against Polish witches, then I suppose we would prefer to flee rather than fight. But if I can convince you that we mean you no harm, then we would much rather stay in Tempe in a state of mutual non-aggression.
Having you leave town sounds pretty good to me. Not much of a downside there, in my view.
I respectfully suggest there might be. Our coven has kept undesirables out of the East Valley for many years now. We have chased off innumerable brujas over the years and a spate of voodoo priests after Katrina hit New Orleans. Last year we quietly took care of a Kali death cult. I also know that there is a group of Bacchants in Vegas that would love to expand here, but we have repulsed every foray into our territory. If you would like to deal with these problems in our absence, so be it.
No. I had no idea that you were so active or so territorial.
This is a nice place to live. We would like to keep it that way.
I like it here, too, I admitted. Very well. Convince me that you mean me no harm.
Are you willing to give us equal assurance?
I suppose that depends on what sort of assurance you seek.
Let us have your lawyer draw up a treaty. We can spend as much time on the wording as you wish. When all parties are satisfied, we will sign in blood and the lawyer will keep it.
A non-aggression treaty signed in blood? Something about that struck me as oxymoronic. I'll begin the process with you in good faith, I said, and see where negotiations lead us. What I want you to understand, what Emily and Radomiwa did not understand, is that though I avoid conflict where I can, it should never be misinterpreted as weakness. You expressed disbelief earlier that a member of the Tuatha De Danann should be afraid of me, but last night I killed him, and on top of that I took care of a horde of demons and your former sisters. I left out all the help I had. I didn't actually kill a single member of her coven, but she didn't need to know that. It should be clear to you that Wikipedia knows nothing about what a real druid can do.
Crystal clear, Mr. O'Sullivan.
Very well. My lawyer will contact you in a week or so. That left me with a wizened witch's head to dispose of, but I was glad that I wouldn't need to use it after all. I knew precisely what to do with it. I cast camouflage on it and myself and crossed the street to Mr. Samurgian's house. With some patient coaxing, the earth underneath his eucalyptus tree opened up and I tumbled her head into a hole beneath its roots, then closed the earth over it and dispelled the camouflage. After that, I sent a courier over to Granuel's place with a check for the money I'd promised and wished her a safe journey. Perry got an early morning call asking him to keep the store running, and in return he'd get a week's paid vacation in a few days. The widow McDonough also received a call, reassuring her that her favorite Irish lad was still alive and planned to have that long talk with her soon. And then, finally, I went to take my rest. I shucked my clothes and lay down on my right side so that my tattoos got maximum contact with the earth. I sighed in relief as I felt the first comforting wave of energy fill my cells. I must have fallen asleep inside of 10 seconds, only to be rudely awakened 10 seconds after that. The Morrigan flew into the yard, cawing loudly, and changed into her human form.
"Now that you are in a position to recharge yourself, Druid, I would like my energy returned to me."
"Well, hello to you too, Morrigan. Eesh." "Thank you very much for the use of it," I told her diplomatically, and offered her my left hand. "Please, take it back." She grasped my hand, and when she was finished draining what was hers, my arm dropped to my side like a dead fish. I couldn't move again.
"You used way too much cold fire," the Morrigan said. "You should plan on being immobile for a couple of days. I hope you put on some of that lotion the mortals are so infatuated with. Can't have you dying of skin cancer."
The Morrigan laughed mockingly and then squawked harshly as she changed into a crow and flew away. And she wondered why she didn't have any friends. Epilogue. The Chiricahua Mountains in southeastern Arizona have a sheer beauty to them. One of the things I enjoy about the desert is the hardiness of the plants and animals that live there. Rains are unpredictable, and the Arizona sun can be extraordinarily harsh. Yet life thrives in the Chiricahuas, albeit without the lush display you find in wetter climes. The Chiricahuas are unusual in that there are several sky islands, old volcanic ranges that jut 9,000 feet above the desert grasslands, featuring diverse ecosystems. Oberon and I hunted mule deer and javelina there, and we also terrorized a couple of coatimundis, just to hear them chitter at us. We didn't find any bighorn sheep, but refused to let that small disappointment mar our idyllic outing.
"This place is great, Atticus,"
he said as we rested by a canyon stream, enjoying the gurgle of the water as it tumbled over rocks and eddied around the stalks of cattails.
"How long can we stay here?"
I wished I could tell him we could stay until he tired of it. This is what I'd fought and lived for, a world without Angus Og in it. There wasn't a place in Tir na n'Og finer than that spot by the creek, and I couldn't remember a time in recent centuries when I'd felt more at peace than there with my friend at that particular moment. It reminded me that Oberon had magic of his own. He could focus my attention on how perfectly sublime life can be at times. Such moments are ephemeral, and without his guidance I might have missed many of them, working so hard to get somewhere that I would fail to recognize when I had arrived. "Just another couple of days," I said. "Then I have to get back to the shop and let Perry take his vacation." There was also the matter of the dead land around Tony Cabin to heal, and I needed to figure out how to grow back a convincing right ear. All I'd been able to do so far was grow a disfigured lump of cartilage, and it had yet to earn me a single admiring glance. I might have to resort to plastic surgery.
"Oh, too bad. I'll enjoy it while it lasts, then."
"I have a surprise for you to enjoy when we get back home."
"Did you get me that movie about Genghis Khan?"
"It's in the Netflix queue, but that's not the surprise. You don't need to worry. It'll be something good. I just don't want you to feel depressed about going home."
"Oh, I won't, but it would be cool to have a stream like this in the backyard. Can you make one?"
No.
"I figured. Can't blame a hound for trying."
Oberon was indeed surprised when we got back home to Tempe. Hal had made the arrangements for me, and Oberon perked up as soon as we were dropped off by the shuttle from the car rental company.
"Hey, smells like someone's in my territory,"
he said. "Nobody could be here without my permission. You know that."
"Flittish did it."
"That isn't Flittish you smell. Believe me." I opened the front door, and Oberon immediately ran to the kitchen window that gazed upon the backyard. He barked joyously when he saw what was waiting for him there.
"French poodles! All black and curly with poofy little tails!"
"And every one of them in heat."
"Oh, wow! Thanks, Atticus! I can't wait to sniff their asses!"
He bounded over to the door and pawed at it because the doggy door was closed to prevent the poodles from entering. "You earned it, buddy. Hold on, get down off the door so I can open it for you. And be careful. Don't hurt any of them." I opened the door, expecting him to bolt through it and dive into his own personal canine harem. But instead he took one step and stopped, looking up at me with a mournful expression, his ears drooping and a tiny whine escaping his snout.
"Only five?"
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Hounded, The Iron Druid Chronicles, by Kevin Hearn. Copyright 2011 by Kevin Hearn. Performed by Luke Daniels. Directed by Max Bloomquist. Engineered by Lee Dries. Performance copyright 2011 Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.